Well, last week we saw the plagues, or better, the strokes, against Egypt begin. And the opening volley was that the Nile River was turned to blood. And as we discussed, the Hebrew term for blood, dam, also denoted the color red. And it means blood-like. So the water in the Nile almost certainly was not real blood. Rather, it was blood red color. It would have been something like a very severe red tide. Now, the reason for us to conclude it was not actual blood is very simple. It affected the Hebrews just as it did the Egyptians. The water stayed bloody red for a full week. Even stored water turned red and rancid. A good portion of the Egyptians and Hebrews would have died if they had no water whatsoever to drink for a week. This event is pictured as a great wonder, not as an event of destruction or death. So apparently by filtering the Nile water, most of the silt or red algae or whatever it was could be removed, making it drinkable. However, the condition of the Nile also had the effect of killing off fish, which undoubtedly had something to do with the form of the next stroke, frogs. It's not that frogs are unusual for the Nile. Rather, it's that there were so many and that they moved quickly away from their normal habitat, the pools and puddles next to their great river, and then they moved into people's homes. Now, the putrid water was at least part of the cause of the frog infestation. And we're going to find as we move along that each of these plagues occurred as a natural progression that we might normally find in nature as a cause and effect kind of situation. In other words, just as the water of the Nile became ill and it resulted in killing off much of the life that the Nile supported, so the effect was to drive the frogs out of the Nile. And when at Moses' command the frogs died, we read of the Egyptians collecting them in great heaps, which decayed and set up a stench all over the land. What usually happens in nature when we have decay? Insects come to feed on it. So, guess what we see next? Just to be clear, I do not want to paint a picture that what we have here is some totally natural phenomenon and coincidence and it all works together with a nice Bible story wrapped around it. Rather, it's that God used natural phenomena, taking it to an extreme level, and brought about at Moses' command. See, this is typically the way the Lord seems to work. Even at the end of days, we read of mountains coming blazing out of the skies and of the sun burning 10 times hotter. We're undoubtedly reading of enormous meteors, comets striking the earth, and it's all happened before. And probably we're reading about very high sunspot activity, which, by the way, is currently on the increase. That ought to make you feel good. But all of these are natural things, just done at a level never before known, so as to upset nature's delicate balance, and it causes catastrophic destruction. Well, now we see God speak to Moses again. He tells Moses to tell Aaron, Moses' prophet, his brother, to use Moses' shepherd's staff to strike the dust of the land with it. This is the third plague. It's also the last plague of the first set of plagues. That is, previously we talked about how the structure of the plagues consists of three sets, with each set consisting of three plagues. 3 times 3 = 9. With the 10th plague actually being the final judgment. And the final judgment happened for not giving in to the earlier demands to free Israel. And notice that as with all three sets of plagues, the third and the last plague of each one of the sets, it comes unannounced to the Pharaoh. That is, we don't see here that Yehovah tells Moses to go to Pharaoh. Rather, he simply instructs Moses to inflict this plague without any warning. It's almost as though in each of the three sets of plagues that Pharaoh refusing to give in to the second plague of each set brought two punishments, two plagues. With the first plague, Pharaoh's warned, punishment occurs. With the second plague, Pharaoh's warned, and the punishment occurs. Then another punishment occurs. Two warnings, three plagues. Why? I don't know. But it's food for thought. Anyway, upon striking the dust, gazillions of gnats, sometimes it's rendered lice, swarmed over the land. Some say maybe it was mosquitoes. These insects were apparently not unknown to the Egyptians, and although I can't prove it, I kind of suspect by their description that these were a variety of super tiny insect that's very much like what we have here in the South called no-see-ums. I mean, having been to Egypt, I can tell you that they definitely have them there. It seems these little bloodsuckers aren't much bigger than a grain of dust, but I swear they have to be all teeth. I mean, because they can get inside anything. And they can bite you in places I don't even want to talk about. But these insects also attack the animals. There is nothing here that says that the attack of the Egyptian no-see-ums was deadly. It must have been just irritating beyond their wildest imagination. And I remind you, it affected the Hebrews as well. So we can set aside any thought that these insect bites were like deadly. Pharaoh again turns to his magicians to discredit Moses and his God. But this time, they could not reproduce what God had done. The extent of their demonic abilities was pretty well exhausted. And thankfully so, because remember, all the magicians had been able to do to this point was to mimic what God had done, and that means to just add to the plague and make it even worse. So they acknowledge to Pharaoh that this is the work of God. Quite an admission. Because it tells Pharaoh that this is a God that he can't order around. And who is very powerful. And he can do things they can't. But the magicians are also saying this was not the work of Moses or Aaron. In other words, by the Egyptian way of thinking, Moses and Aaron were Hebrew magicians. And up to now, it seemed to be a battle of Egypt sorcerers against the Israelite sorcerers. And the Pharaoh sorcerers basically say, hey, it's not our fault, because it wasn't a fair fight. They didn't lose to Moses and Aaron. They were defeated directly by their God. This is the sense of their statement, this is the finger of God. Further, the Hebrew word translated God here is Elohim, Elohim. That is, the magicians say, surely this is the work of Elohim. And Elohim is a somewhat generic Hebrew word that means God or goddess, a divine ruler of some kind or another. And when a Hebrew speaks of Elohim, usually he's referring to God Almighty. But in this case, when it's the words of the Egyptian sorcerers being quoted, it's not like they understood or knew the Hebrew God, Yehovah or Yahweh, nor were they giving him his due honor. They just knew that this unknown God, this Elohim, of the Hebrews was the one who caused the insects to come and swarm, and that they and their Egyptian Elohims, the Egyptian gods, seemed to have no power to either imitate it or to stop it. Now, amazingly, even this frightful admission of their powerlessness in the face of the Hebrew God failed to sway Pharaoh. This leader cared not for his people or his nation's well-being. He cared only for his own personal pride and power. Even more, Pharaoh now thoroughly understood, had there been any doubt at all, that he was doing battle more with God than with Moses. Had there been even the slightest ignorance of this reality up to this point, it was now dismissed. Pharaoh was fully accountable to God and to his people for his actions. Well, Yehovah again speaks to Moses as he sends the demand once more to Pharaoh to free the Hebrews. Now, interestingly, it seems that we have some of the circumstances surrounding this coming fourth plague. We've had them before. God tells Moses to go confront Pharaoh where he goes to the water, meaning where he goes to the Nile. This must certainly have been the same place where Moses waited for Pharaoh for that first stroke when the Nile was turned blood red. Now, the consequences for not freeing Israel will be another attack of insects, but there's a very important difference this time. This stroke, the fourth one, is the first stroke of the second set of strokes. And this begins a time when only the people of Egypt will feel its effects, not the Hebrews. And God says, but I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people live. And yes, I will distinguish between my people and your people. These insects were a known, dreaded species of fly called by the locals in Egypt dog flies. They're a real problem, particularly as concerned the livestock. They tend to fasten themselves to moist areas in the corners of the animal's eyes, on their eyelids, around their nostrils. They would even deposit their eggs and cause severe inflammation up to and including blindness, death. And of course, we're all too familiar with how flies bring diseases, and it will affect humans. We are told that these flies simply took over the land. So as with the other plagues, this was not a new phenomena. These flies were known to show up from time to time. But what was different, you see, was the intensity of their attack, their enormous number, and they appeared at Moses' command. But by far the most perplexing matter for Pharaoh, for his magicians, for the Egyptian people, had to be that these dog flies only infested Egyptian homes and their livestock. The Israelites were left unscathed. Now, while God had certainly made his point that he sees Israel as separate and apart from Egypt, it couldn't have made the relationship between the Hebrew and Egyptian people any easier. You know, it's human nature that suffering is supposed to be equally shared, right? One can imagine that the Egyptian citizens became pretty angry that the Israelites stood above this woe of flies that killed the livestock from which no Egyptian, not even Pharaoh, seemed to be able to escape. Well, people just hate it that one group thinks they're special, especially if those people are not an accepted part of that group. This is the same situation for believers today. Who among us have not been told that we're pretty arrogant to think that we have a special place with God because of our belief in Messiah, but they don't? How often have we heard that Christians and Messianic Jews seem to think that we have something available to us, wisdom, love, blessing, favor, that others don't. And it's near impossible to explain to non-believers that it's not that we're somehow better than them, because we're not. It's that because of our trust and faith in Yeshua, it is God who has separated us from them. He distinguishes those who trust him from everybody else. That principle and pattern is the very essence of salvation. And it's demonstrated right here in Exodus. It's the reason that the world has always hated Israel. It's the reason that the world increasingly hates Christians. The church has become so sensitive to this hatred, especially as of late with the ideological war that has erupted between us and Islam, that many are going out of their way to say that faith in any spiritual being and espousing a set of doctrines that's built upon their faith is a good and valid faith. Essentially pronouncing that God makes no distinction among peoples or nations or what a person might have faith in. Now, the world's reasoning is you cannot simultaneously have distinction with tolerance. I mean, after all, isn't the church supposed to be all about unity, love, peace, and harmony? Distinction and tolerance are mutually exclusive. Therefore, say a loud and growing body of Christian leaders, it must be that we all worship the same God, whether we call him Allah, Hindi, Yehovah, or Jesus. It's just that these poor, misguided persons don't know that they're actually worshiping the Savior. Now, if you believe that, then I suppose you also believe that poor Pharaoh was also actually just worshiping the God of the Hebrews and not his own Egyptian gods. He was just ignorant of that. Now, let me warn you as strongly as I can. God distinguishing one people from another is all that separates you and me from an eternity apart from him. That distinction is only based on one thing: trust in our Savior. That's it. As nice and warm and fuzzy and peace-loving as it sounds to embrace all gods as the God, do not buy into this new age or emergent church tolerance that is rapidly being adopted by too many within the Christian and Jewish community. Well, Pharaoh calls to Moses and to Aaron. And he says, okay, go ahead, gather your people and have your festival. Make your sacrifices to your God, but do it in the land. Don't leave Egypt. Now, Moses is all too aware that the Egyptian people with their sick livestock and themselves covered with dog fly bites aren't very happy with the Hebrews right about now. And he tells Pharaoh that if they hold their festival locally, the Egyptians will erupt. Instead, Moses said, let us go 3 days' journey out into the wilderness, the desert, as God's instructed, and hold the festival out of the sight of the Egyptian people. And Pharaoh says, okay, go ahead, just not too far, but please go plead with your God to call off the attack of the dog flies. Now, although it's hard to discern from our English translations, Pharaoh has actually taken a significant step here. In verse 28 of the more typical English Bibles and verse 24 of the older Hebrew Bible structure, like our complete Jewish Bible, Pharaoh tells Moses that he may take the Israelites and sacrifice to God or to the Lord or to Adonai or something like that. But actually, the original Hebrew says Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah or Yahweh, depending on how you want to pronounce it. Not Lord, not God, not Adonai. Pharaoh calls the Hebrew God by his name. Now, this is quite a concession. There is actually some respect growing here. Now, further understand that what the Hebrews would be sacrificing, oxen, cattle, among other animals, all these particular animals were holy to the Egyptians. If the Hebrews were to kill and burn up a bull, which surely they would have, in sight of the Egyptians, I remember a bull is one of their most divine gods, it would have been a grievous offense. And indeed, the Egyptians would have sought terrible retribution. Notice that Moses didn't mention to Pharaoh exactly what those sacrificial animals were going to be. He just said that for sure the Egyptian people would stone them for it. Well, unfortunately, that still didn't stop Pharaoh from reacting just as he had previously. As soon as the flies left the next day, Pharaoh retracts his promise. Let's move on to Exodus chapter 9. Exodus chapter 9. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 68. Exodus chapter 9. We're going to read it all. Long chapter. Then Adonai said to Moshe, "Go to Pharaoh and tell him, 'Here is what Adonai, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go so that they can worship me. If you refuse to let them go and persist in holding on to them, the hand of Adonai is on your livestock in the field, on the horses, donkeys, camels, cattle, and flocks, and will make them suffer a devastating illness. But Adonai will distinguish between Egypt's and Israel's livestock. Nothing belonging to the people of Israel will die.' Well, Adonai determined the exact time by saying, 'Tomorrow Adonai will do this in the land.' The following day Adonai did. All the livestock of Egypt died, but not one of the animals belonging to the people of Israel died. Pharaoh investigated. He found out that not even one of the animals of the people of Israel had died. Nevertheless, Pharaoh's heart remained stubborn, and he didn't let the people go. Well, Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, 'Take handfuls of ash from a kiln and let Moses throw them in the air before Pharaoh's eyes. They will turn into fine dust all over the land of Egypt and become infected sores on men and animals throughout Egypt.' So they took ashes from a kiln, stood in front of Pharaoh, and threw them into the air, and they became infected sores on men and animals. The magicians couldn't even stand in Moses' presence because of the sores, which were on them as well as on the other Egyptians. But Adonai made Pharaoh hard-hearted, so that he didn't listen to them, just as Adonai had said to Moshe. And Adonai said to Moshe, 'Get up early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh and say to him, Here is what Adonai says. Let my people go so that they can worship me. For this time, I will inflict my plagues on you yourself and on your officials and your people so that you will realize I am without equal in all the earth. By now, I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with such severe plagues, you would have been wiped off the earth. But it is for this very reason that I kept you alive, to show you my power, so that my name may resound throughout the whole earth. Since you are still setting yourself up against my people and not letting them go, tomorrow, about this time, I will cause a hailstorm so heavy that Egypt has had nothing like it from the day it was founded until now. Therefore, hurry to bring indoors all your livestock and everything else you have in the field, for hail will fall on every human being and animal left in the field that hasn't been brought home, and they will die. Whoever among Pharaoh's servants feared what Adonai had said had his slaves and livestock escape into the houses. But those who had no regard for what Adonai had said left their slaves and livestock in the field. Adonai said to Moshe, reach out your hand toward the sky so that there will be hail in all the land of Egypt falling on people, animals, everything growing in the field throughout the land of Egypt. Moses reached out with his staff towards the sky, and Adonai sent thunder and hail. Fire ran down on the earth. Adonai caused it to hail on the land of Egypt. It hailed, and fire flashed up with the hail. It was terrible. Worse than any hailstorm in all of Egypt since it had become a nation. Throughout all the land of Egypt, the hail struck everything in the field, people and animals. The hail struck every plant growing in the field, broke every tree there. But in the land of Goshen, where the people of Israel were, there was no hail. Pharaoh summoned Moshe and Aharon and said to them, "This time I have sinned. Adonai is right. I and my people are in the wrong. Intercede with Adonai. We can't take any more of this terrible thunder and hail. And I will let you go and you will stay no longer." And Moses said to him, "As soon as I've gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands to Adonai. The thunder will end. There won't be any more hail, so that you can know that the earth belongs to Adonai. But you and your servants, I know you still won't fear Adonai, God." The flax and the barley were ruined because the barley was ripe, the flax in bud. But the wheat and buckwheat was not ruined because they come up later. Moshe went out of the city, away from Pharaoh, spread out his hands to Adonai. The thunder and hail ended. The rain stopped pouring down on the earth. And when Pharaoh saw that the rain, hail, and thunder had ended, he sinned still more by making himself hard-hearted, he and his servants. Pharaoh was made hard-hearted. He didn't let the people of Israel go, just as Adonai had said through Moshe. Pharaoh's heart has remained hard. Now let's recall that this hardening was a combination of Pharaoh beginning with a rebellious and hardened heart, and then later on God intervening to further harden Pharaoh's heart from time to time. Well, for what purpose would God do this? He tells us directly why. He says that Egypt and Israel, the people, the common folk, they would see all of these signs and wonders. It was important to God that every one of these 9 plagues came to pass. Pharaoh was merely God's tool to show the people of Egypt the power of Jehovah, the worthlessness of their own false gods and false religion. Well, they haven't seen anything yet. We're approaching the halfway point in the signs and wonders being manifested now. They're about to take a jump in intensity. Jehovah sends Moses back to Pharaoh with essentially the same message as before. Free my people. My people. Remember that we've learned that a particular Hebrew word is used when God is referring to the nation of Hebrews and not to any other nation or people group. That word is ami or amim, which is plural. And when the scriptures refer to non-Hebrews in the same context, it uses the Hebrew word goy or goyim. The word in verse 1, "send free my people," is ami. The Lord is dividing and separating the goyim, the Gentiles, from the ami, the Hebrews, his people. Now the next plague, the next stroke for Pharaoh, once again refusing God's demand, is a terrible sickness upon the livestock of the field. This stroke is the 5th. This makes it the 2nd plague of the 2nd set of plagues. The entire 2nd set of plagues is reserved only for the Egyptians, as opposed to the 1st set of plagues, which affected everybody, Hebrews included. So the livestock that will be struck down will only be Egyptian livestock. Now, depending on your version, verse 3 says horses, donkeys, and camels will be among those affected. Then your Bibles will say either herds and flocks or oxen and sheep, they'll be struck as well. The Hebrew here is bakar and tzon. Bakar and tzon. Now, bakar, that can mean oxen. But here, it's better taken to just mean cattle, because cattle were to the Egyptians what sheep were to the Israelites. It was their favorite and most farmed source of meat. Tzon can mean sheep or goats. Pretty much any kind of smaller kind of livestock. It can even mean small or young cattle, cows, but it refers specifically to animals eaten for food, as distinct from beasts of burden, like donkeys or camels. In fact, it likely means, in this context, all of your small livestock, every kind, sheep, pigs, goats, young cattle. So likely the essence of the statement in verse 3 means every kind of livestock used for food that the Egyptians own, large and small. That's what it's actually saying. Now, what's not included are wild animals, non-domesticated animals. Apparently, they weren't affected since they weren't owned by anyone except by God. Well, verse 6 tells us that all the livestock that belonged to the Egyptians died. However, none of the livestock of the Hebrews died. And when Pharaoh heard rumors that the Israelites' animals had survived, in absolute disbelief, he sent officials to see if this could be true. And it was verified. But Pharaoh still would not relent. Now, as an aside, could it be that all, as the scriptures say, of the livestock of the Egyptians died? There's really nothing in the wording to indicate otherwise. Now, sometimes we get good indications in certain scriptures that all is merely an expression. That is, all or even forever or every doesn't necessarily mean 100%. It just indicates the sense of the vast majority or almost all or almost entirely. However, in this case, the all seems to imply all, as in every last one of the Egyptians' livestock, large and small, perished. What would have happened is that the Egyptians probably confiscated some of the Israelites' livestock and then purchased some additional stock from surrounding nations. See, the world at this time was far more connected than most people today realize. Trade among nations was an everyday affair. No matter, this was a humiliating and a devastating blow to the Egyptian people, to their food supply. Well, in verse 8, we come to the unannounced plague number 6, third plague of the second set of plagues. So the Pharaoh receives no warning that this is coming. It's as if each time refuses, we'll say, I told you this earlier, each time the Pharaoh refuses the second demand of a set of plagues, there's two plagues as a response to that. One announced, one not. I don't want to overplay this concept of three sets of three plagues, everything it entails, and make it an intellectual exercise, but I would like you to begin to drink in that. Beginning with Genesis 1, we see God establish patterns and types and principles. God is a God of order. He's not a God of chaos or serendipity. The scriptures lay down many patterns and types for us, so that in our lives we can reasonably know the general nature of how our God responds to us and to our various circumstances. If this was not so, then history, including the history being given to us in the Bible, would be utterly useless, except as a curiosity, something to satisfy our love of knowledge. If history did not show us God's patterns and principles, if we did not see them as constantly repeated, then we would have good reason to doubt a very important pillar of our faith, that God never changes. There's not even a shadow of turning in him, we're taught. These patterns are a great proof and reassurance of God's unchanging nature, and it means we can be confident that the way even the last days of this world play out will be the same patterns that he's created since creation. But it also means that as we learn in our study of the Torah about these principles, about these governing dynamics, we are also to take the New Testament in that same context. It is in the Torah that these patterns and principles of God are first established. It's in the New Testament that they're brought to a fuller and higher meaning by Yeshua, Jesus of Nazareth. This sixth plague that is brought upon Egypt without warning, is painful boils and blisters. This affects man and beast. What kind of beast? It's not clear. The Hebrew word is behema, and it can mean livestock. It can even mean every type of animal. Verses 8 and 9 say that Moses and Aaron were to be actively involved in making this plague occur. They were by their own hands to take soot, throw it up into the air, whereupon it would disperse and it would land upon all living creatures. It would cause painful pustules to arise. And not only could Pharaoh's magicians not imitate this miracle, they were afflicted with the boils. But the Hebrew people were exempted. Now, plagues of boils upon man and beast were a known happening. They occurred for reasons unknown from time to time. There are many known diseases that cause blisters to occur. Many of the poxes we're all familiar with, such as measles, but also the terribly, terribly deadly variety like smallpox. It does not appear, though, that this was a deadly disease. Rather, it just brought great discomfort. However, a plague of boils that affected only the Egyptian people and animals and not the Hebrews, and one that was so extensive and catastrophic, this is unheard of. This is not natural. And when I hear of this description of fine dust, soot, being thrown into the air, dispersed by the wind, and it comes in contact with the skin of a man and or even beasts, and it causes blistering, I can't help but think of things like mustard gas and the gassing of the Kurdish people by Saddam Hussein and all kinds of terrible weapons developed by mankind. And while I don't think that this sixth plague is some veiled prophecy of the chemical weapons of our day, I do think that one is a satanic counterfeit of the other. These horrible 21st century weapons that can cause such agony and destruction, these have not been wrought by God, but rather by the evil one for the indiscriminate killing of humanity. It was for the salvation of God's people that God used this fine dust to cause pain only to those who held God's people as their slaves. And this is so they might know God and repent and let his people go. Well, without going into details, the words of verse 12 tell us that the Pharaoh's heart remains strong-willed and hardened despite this pain even he was not exempted from, just as God had told Moses it would be. God attacked the Egyptians' wealth, their livestock, their livelihoods, their pride, their own bodies, laid low their gods and these gods' priests. And as bad as the first six plagues had been, they were benign as compared to the ferocity of the next set of three. God gives Pharaoh in verse 14 a grave warning. This time, I will set my blows upon your heart. And the word used for heart is different from version to version. Some say person, some say self. The complete Jewish Bible says you. See, the Hebrew word here is lev, and its essence is that of the inner self, a man's soul, where our conscience, where our emotions, where our will, where our sense of who we are resides. In other words, what was about to come would not just affect Pharaoh's anger and his stubbornness. It would finally penetrate that thick head and skin of his. It would attack his inner being. It would hurt far deeper than anything prior. Well, the seventh plague, the first plague of the third set, would be hail of a size and an intensity never before seen in Egypt. Hail, you say, in the desert? Sure. I was born and raised in the Mojave Desert of California. And in the middle of a 120-degree day, I have seen hail fall during a thunderstorm. It was rare. It only happened every few years, but in an intense thunderstorm, you see, wind causes rain droplets to be carried up towards the higher, colder reaches of the atmosphere. And up there they freeze and they're joined to other droplets to form ice. And then they return to Earth so fast, they hit the ground as blobs of hardened ice. And of course they melt almost immediately. But I've seen, personally, entire crops wiped out from a hailstorm in midsummer. I've seen car windshields broken, terrible roof damage. But verse 18 says, never in the history of Egypt had such hail fell as was about to. It would occur even as intense lightning was happening. Well, back up in verse 15, God wants Moses and Aaron to make clear to Pharaoh that God had actually been holding himself back. That he'd only sent plagues, strokes up to now that did not bring wholesale destruction, because if he had, Egypt and the people of Egypt would have been no more. And in verse 16, God says, the reason he has done this is not only that Israel might know him, but that throughout the land of Egypt, that the people of Egypt would know him and remember him. Now, this is no idle throw-in phrase. It might surprise you to know that up until a mere 40 years or so ago, Egypt was a majority Christian nation. And before that, from the time of the Roman Empire, even before Jesus, and on into the Middle Ages, Egypt was a center of Jewish religious authority and a center of Hebrew culture and learning. Egypt, in fact, the city of Alexandria, Egypt, and its outskirts had Jewish colonies that records indicate had more than 1 million Jews. And today, we actually have had a lawsuit filed in the world court by Egyptians demanding that Israel return with interest all the gold and other stuff they got from the Egyptians at the time of the Exodus. Egypt has indeed been impressed by these plagues caused by Pharaoh's hardened heart. And they have remembered, just as God said he wanted them to, and millions of Egyptians have entered eternity saved by Christ, and it's all laid out right here in Exodus. In fact, take a look at verse 20. Here we see that as a result of the first six plagues, some number of the Egyptian people had indeed learned that this God of the Hebrews was not to be trifled with. They now knew the power of Jehovah, and many brought their livestock indoors when they got the warning, into caves, into other shelter. They brought their field workers in from the fields, into their homes, protect them. They believed the hail and the lightning was coming. Yet, as always, many more followed Pharaoh's mindset, and they ignored the warning, even though about once a month, over the past 6 months, these terrible calamities kept occurring, four of which came with a prior warning. We're reminded in verse 26 that in the land of Goshen, that region of Egypt set apart for the Hebrews, the hail did not fall. The lightning did not strike. The Hebrews did not experience this devastation, only the Egyptians. People were killed, livestock were killed and damaged, trees were destroyed, the field crops were smashed, most of them lost. This time even Pharaoh was moved. He called for Moses and Aaron and admitted, I have sinned. He asked Moses to plead with his God to stop this terrible catastrophe. He even said he wanted the Israelites to go, to leave. Of course, it was not that Pharaoh had taken God into his heart. It was only that he fully understood that Yehovah was real and powerful, and he feared the consequences of angering him further. Moses said as much in verse 30, "Oh, what a monumental error it is to think that believing that God exists and complying with his demands out of fear of the consequences is the basis for attaining righteousness and salvation. We must trust God. We must trust Yeshua. We must take him into our heart. We must respond in obedience to him out of love and out of gratitude. As the word says, you know what? Even the demons believe that God is. They tremble before him. Even the demons obey God, just as they did when Yeshua ordered them out of a man and into a herd of pigs. We're no different than Pharaoh or demons if all we do is believe that God is and follow his commandments out of fear of the repercussions, if we don't. In verses 31 and 32, we get a pretty good idea of the time of year that this hailstorm occurred. Pretty easy to figure out, because we're told the barley was in ears in the ripening stage and the flax was in buds just behind the development of the barley. But that the wheat and the spelt, something spelt's what we call today buckwheat, they were not devastated because they were in their very early stages of development. So this would have been into January, first part of February, probably. Maybe a little later, but not quite to spring. And despite the death and damage and economic disaster of this seventh stroke, Pharaoh went back on his word to free Israel. The minute he saw that lightning and hail stop. Verse 34 tells us that the Pharaoh's servants, meaning his government officials and the citizens at large of Egypt, they also hardened their hearts. But how would this have manifested itself upon the Hebrews? What did this general hardening of Egypt towards Israel mean for the Israelites? Same thing it does now, 3,300 years later. Irrational hatred aimed at the Israelis. Even though it means terrible hardship and calamity upon those who do the hating. Or using the words the Bible uses, those who curse Israel will themselves be cursed. Look at these Middle Eastern nations today. Nations who hate Israel, curse Israel, try over and over again to do away with Israel. Iraq is now occupied by foreigners, as is Afghanistan. The Palestinians have 70% unemployment. They live in terrible squalor, without hope. Egypt is a poor nation, although it's currently at peace with Israel. Iran sits on the edge of civil war, has the world lining up against it. Syria is in the midst of a devastating civil war that has seen death and destruction on a huge scale. All these nations can think of day in and day out is how to destroy the homeland of the Jews. A Palestinian Arab friend of mine, Tass, who, by the way, is currently living in Jericho, told me that killing Jews and eradicating Israel is the driving force. It is the goal behind every decision made by the Palestinians. It dominates their thoughts, their lives, even though it brings nothing but a life of poverty and deprivation. Why do they think this way? Why? Is it that the Israelis sit on some kind of big wealth? Oil, minerals, precious metals? Israel doesn't have, they found some oil and so on, but it's going to have to be shared with Lebanon, and it's not going to change them much. No, it's a spiritual issue. It's a Satan-driven hatred that brings nothing but their own self-destruction. But it's also a God-ordained consequence, inescapable for those who hate Israel, whether it was Pharaoh in Egypt in Moses' day, or the Palestinians and Iraqis and Arabs and most of the rest of the world today. Westerners and Christians are not exempted from this principle. You and I have a choice. Just as Pharaoh had a choice. Bless Israel or curse Israel. That's our choice. There's no neutrality. It frightens me to my toes when I watch our U.S. president criticize Israel for defending themselves. It turns my stomach when Jewish leaders forcefully dispossess Jews from the very land God gave to them. It angers me red-faced when I hear church leaders condemn Israel and go side with the Arabs. Equating Israel, hunting down and jailing terrorist leaders or defending themselves from rocket attacks with Palestinian homicide bombers that indiscriminately blow up crowded public buses and pizzerias and shoot anti-tank missiles at Israeli school buses full of children, this is so dishonest and despicable. A constant cry goes out for even-handedness from the UN, from the left, to see the actions of the Israelis and of their enemies as the same. There's no even-handedness when choosing between good and evil. For your own good, for the good of your family, for the good of this nation, I ask you to join with Seed of Abraham Ministries and unapologetically bless Israel at every opportunity you get. If you do not do this, you are no different than Pharaoh. All that this wrong attitude proves is that while you may well believe that God exists, you simply do not believe what he says or who he declares is his precious treasure. Sooner or later, it's going to lead to destruction. Well, next week we'll get into Exodus chapter 10.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.